Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, how genes impact heredity, disease, and behavior, and how that knowledge can be used. But up front, Pennsylvania's Republican U.S. Senator Pat Toomey is a conservative who has voted on bills when he was in the House and Senate with his Republican colleagues more than 80% and closer to 90% of the time. However, Toomey announced late last year that he would not seek a third term in the Senate and wouldn't run for governor. So when Toomey was among seven Republicans in the Senate who voted to convict former President Donald Trump in his impeachment trial, many pointed to Toomey leaving office, not having to face voters again, and that he was not beholden to the party. Those who support term limits for elected officials say Toomey is a good example of a senator voting for what he thought was right, as opposed to what was best for his reelection or party. On today's program, we discuss term limits and whether it is a reform that would make elected officials more accountable. Joining us on today's program, Mike Riley, legislative advocate with the organization U.S. Term Limits, Ken Quinn, Northern Regional Director with U.S. Term Limits, and Republican State Representative Ryan McKenzie of Lehigh and Berks Counties. Ryan McKenzie, Representative McKenzie, I want to start with you. You support congressional term limits. Why?
Absolutely. So thanks for having me on the show. And I've been a supporter of term limits. It's an idea that has strong, popular, bipartisan support. And the mechanism to actually implement term limits goes through the state legislature. The opposition is always, well, how can you get a constitutional amendment to term limits for Congress if Congress won't pass a limit on themselves? And so, thankfully, the U.S. Supreme Court has allowed and given us a path forward, and that's through an Article 5 convention. And I believe that's something that we in the state legislature take up and do. And so that's why I've been a supporter of it.
When you say that it has strong bipartisan support, maybe across the country, but if it has strong bipartisan support, why hasn't it happened not only here in Pennsylvania, but as you say, this would be an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It would take more than 30 states to sign on to something like this. Where is that support?
That's correct. So what you're seeing is you're seeing growing interest in this here in Pennsylvania. About 12 states across the country have already passed an Article 5 convention effort like this at the state level. I've introduced something like this here in Pennsylvania. This is now, I believe, the second term or so. And I'm now on the state government committee. And so we're looking to have a hearing on this topic this session, start to raise awareness for it here in the Pennsylvania legislature. And again, the early discussions that I've had have been bipartisan in nature, and the support is growing in Pennsylvania. So it's obviously a different topic. I think some people have concerns about Article 5 conventions because it's a different and new idea that is being promoted here at the state level. And so I think people are, want to be cautious because this is a change that we're proposing to the U.S. Constitution. That's a big change. So people want to move cautiously and carefully with that.
You have introduced this resolution before. How far has it made it? Now, you're saying that there could be hearings on it now. How far has it made it in the past? And has anything changed that there would be more support for it?
So what I think I'm seeing is, again, a long process. I've worked on legislative initiatives and efforts in the legislature that have taken years to come to fruition. So, a lot of things, even if they're good ideas or popular ideas, they can take a long time to go through the legislative process. And so I'm digging in for the long haul on something like this. And, I think you have to play the long game. And so what that means for me is building awareness amongst my members, looking and talking to our chairman of the state government committee, and hopefully getting a hearing on this this session. Then again, once you get that information comes out at a hearing, you can start building that coalition of supporters who would actually move a bill. So again, I'm under no illusions or impressions that this is something that's going to be a snap decision, and I don't think it should be. So we want to take our time. We want to have a full airing, full vetting of the idea and the proposal, and continue to move it forward in a methodical fashion, though.
If you're just tuning in, we know this is a topic that many people have opinions on. Term limits for members of Congress, and maybe we'll talk about on the state level as well. But if you have a question or a comment in particular, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We'd like to hear your opinions on term limits. Mike Riley, you're the legislative advocate for the organization U.S. Term Limits. First of all, let me ask about U.S. term limits. What is it? What is your organization trying to do, even though I think your name pretty much says it all?
Thanks. Appreciate the opportunity, Scott. U.S. Term Limits is a nonprofit. It's based in Washington, D.C., and they're working in many, many states, as Representative McKenzie alluded to, currently working, I think, in like 8 other states. My job here in Pennsylvania is to help spread the word about Article 5 and the Term Limits Resolution, working with Representative McKenzie and the other sponsors. And I really focus on our representatives and answering their questions or any issues that they may have with the whole concept of a term limits resolution. And so I work at the Harrisburg level and working at the local level. We have people working at the national level that are part of U.S. term limits. And then below me, at the state level, we have a state director, and we have grassroots efforts going on with lots of portions of Pennsylvania, to include Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and here in the middle, where we are reaching out to our representatives and expressing our support for this resolution, and trying to grow that grassroots effort, supporting the efforts that Representative McKenzie is doing at the Harrisburg level.
Ken Quinn, you're the Northern Regional Director for U.S. Term Limits. Maybe we need some context here. I think most people know what we're talking about with term limits, but what exactly is being proposed here?
Yes, Scott, thank you so much for having us on this morning. Yeah, I'll give you a quick overview. So U.S. term limits has been around since 1992. And back in the 90s, there was a very strong push to put term limits not only on state legislatures, but also members of Congress. And in fact, 23 states passed laws, most of them at the ballot box, limiting the own terms of their own congressional delegations. And unfortunately, what happened in the case against us, it went to the U.S., it got challenged. And in the case U.S. Term Limits versus Thornton, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned all of those 23 state laws and ruled that the only way this could be accomplished was by an amendment to the U.S. Constitution under Article 5. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with Article 5, that's the amending provision. It's very short. It's one long, long sentence. And in a nutshell, there's only two ways amendments can be proposed. Either two-thirds of both houses need to pass the amendment, and then it goes out to the states for ratification. It takes three-fourths, which is 38 states today, to ratify an amendment. The second option, which has never been done before, it's the framers gave the state legislatures equal authority with Congress. And what we need is 34 states, which is two-thirds of the states, to concur on the subject, to call the convention. So our subject would be congressional term limits. It's limited to what the two-thirds of the states submit applications on. And then how the process works, this was actually put in the Constitution as a way to bypass completely Congress. The framers, in their wisdom, knew that we need a check and a balance. And so this is how the states can amend the Constitution without the consent or approval or even a vote from Congress. And obviously, I think most of us would agree, we don't think Congress is going to limit their own terms. And so this is really the only path that we can get this done.
I want to come back to Representative McKenzie. Okay, we've talked a lot in the first few minutes about the process itself, and obviously it is not a simple process, and there would be a lot to do to get to a constitutional convention and amend the Constitution for term limits. Why do you support term limits? Why do you think it's a good idea?
I think term limits are a good idea because what we see, especially at the congressional level, is that members are far away from their constituency, and the amount of time that they're spending in Congress is growing over history. And so, you know, I think this leads to people being further away from their constituents and not representing their communities as well. So, you know, there is a mechanism here in place that, as Ken spelled out, is in the Constitution. The U.S. Supreme Court has pointed us in that direction. And so I think this is a very viable path for us, especially in state legislatures, to take up and again, speak for our constituents who, again, have overwhelmingly supported this. There have been polls, 70-80% of people, again, bipartisan in nature, support an effort like this. And I think the displeasure that we're seeing with Congress, you know, is something that has been out there for a long time, but is growing lately. And so I think this is a manifestation of that. People would like to see new ideas come forward. And one way that you could do that and refresh the Congress would be through term limits.
Ken Quinn, what would be different if, say, a member of the House was limited to 3 2-year terms or 4 2-year terms? A Senate, 1 6-year term, something like that. What would be different? I mean, why are term limits a good idea then?
Yeah, well, what we're seeing right now is we have politicians who go down to Washington, and I think with good intent, but unfortunately, the way the system is, they become trapped into this cycle of having to raise a lot of money for their next reelection and also for their party. So, for those of you that might not know how this system works, in order for them to get key chairmanship positions, they have to raise money. It's all based on who raises the most money. And so it becomes this path of not appointing the best person for the position, but who has raised the most money. And so what we need to do is change that structure where the representatives and the senators that we send down to Washington know that they can't turn this into a lifelong career. They have a limited amount of time to get the job done that their constituents sent them down there to do. And unfortunately, the way it is set up right now is it's virtually impossible to vote out an incumbent. Actually, the parties try to stop any challengers. 97% of the corporate PAC money goes to the incumbents. And it's really the advantages the incumbents have over any challengers is just, you know, it cannot be overcome on a consistent basis. And so the only way to fix that is by limiting the time in office that these people spend down there so that we can have new people with fresh ideas. A lot of the incumbents, how many years have been hearing about the same problems, a balanced budget amendment, healthcare? The reason we don't have these solutions is because the incumbents are not willing to make those tough decisions that need to be made because they do not want to threaten their reelection opportunities. And so that's where term limits would really benefit the American people. We will see people from different backgrounds participating in our government. And we as voters, we will have more choices at the ballot box, which for me, I think is one of the best reasons to have term limits because I'm so tired myself of having to vote for the lesser of two evils. Where I would like to have a choice in open seat, fair, competitive elections will provide that opportunity for all of us.
Well, Ken, you know, and I know you've heard some of the objections to this, but there are those who say that we already have term limits. It's called an election, and that voters can decide if they don't want an incumbent to go back to Washington. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, and that's just a smokescreen by those that want to protect the establishment. I sort of answered that because the elections are very, it's virtually impossible. There's so many advantages that the incumbents have. I liken it to like a Major League Baseball game where a Major League team takes on a Little League team. Yeah, technically it's a true baseball game, but who's going to win? It's going to be the Major League because they have the money advantage. They have the name recognition. They have the PACs, lobbyists, special interest groups all supporting them. And so we what we truly need. And what's really missing today is most of, in fact, Pennsylvania, your first constitution had term limits. Our first constitution, the Articles of Confederation, had term limits. Back then, they were called rotation of office. And the framers and our founders understood that anyone who can hold a seat for too long can be corrupted. And they wanted to prevent that corruption from spreading. And so that's why they had term limits in their original constitutions. And we can't change human nature at the ballot box. So we can vote for people year after year after year. However, human nature does not change. And when people have an opportunity to gain great wealth and a lot of power, that will corrupt. And so the only way to keep that corruption down and limited is through this process of term limits. And that's why we need the state legislatures to step up and use their authority under Article 5 and propose this amendment.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today, Mike Riley, legislative advocate with U.S. Term Limits, Ken Quinn, Northern Regional Director with U.S. Term Limits, and Republican State Representative Ryan McKenzie, who serves Lehigh and Berks counties. We're talking about term limits. Do you support? Do you oppose? Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk at WITF.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk. WITF. Let's take a phone call from Nathan in Harrisburg. Nathan, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi, thank you. First of all, I do support the idea of term limits. I also really like the framing of rotation of office. I hadn't heard that before, so I think that kind of gets to the issue a little bit more, that we need to keep it fresh, so we need to keep it rotating. And I also appreciate the call out to human nature, because we often underrate the risk of the status quo. So I think those are important things to keep in mind. I do have a question. It's more procedural and kind of secondarily a strategic question. I'm not 100% convinced that grassroots lobbying won't be able to bring about term limits, but I'll just cede that point for now. And it's been said that this is the only way, this convention of states is the only way to bring about congressional term limits, but that doesn't necessarily make it more efficacious or any easier. Are there specific reasons that term limits are likely to succeed as an amendment through this unused process, or is it just like a last-ditch effort because it seems like the only way to get it through?
Thank you very much for your call, Nathan. Who wants to take that one?
I'll take that one if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
I think this is something that will be successful, and it absolutely needs to be grassroots. Most amendments to our Constitution started this way, at the grassroots. In fact, 17 of our amendments started through the Article 5 application process at the state legislatures. So this is how it begins. The reason why I believe this will be successful through this process is because this one amendment is so highly supported by the American people, and that's what's required. It can't be seen as a party issue, which this issue is not. In fact, there was a poll taken in Pennsylvania just a year ago by the Pulse Opinion Research, and 79% of the voters in Pennsylvania support this, and that breaks out 78% Republicans, 79% Democrats, and 77% Independents. And so what's nice about what we're doing, and I think it's now the Article 5 process is, it's a mystery to some. It really shouldn't be, because it's very simple, but this is one amendment that's nonpartisan. People already understand what term limits does and how it works, so it's not a policy issue. It's also something that has such a high, overwhelming support of the American people, and we've done it before. The 22nd Amendment placed term limits on the president. That was ratified in 1951, and that is something our organization commemorates every year now. It's Term Limits Day on February 27th, the commemoration of that ratification. And so if term limits are good enough for the president, then I think we agree that term limits are good enough for the members of Congress. And so that's why I think it will be accomplished hopefully soon.
Mike Riley, I want to put this one to you. This is from a listener who asks, my question is, who would want to spend the time and effort to run for office with the understanding that they most likely will have to leave their current job if that they know that their term is very limited?
So I think from my perspective, I think having term limits will allow them to make the hard decisions that need to be made, as Ken alluded to earlier. So if they're spending 30 hours out of every work week working on raising money in order to get themselves reelected, and the only thing they care about is continuing to be reelected, because let's face it, if you're in D.C. and you're treated like a king, you don't want to give that job up very easily. And so I think by having term limits and kind of forcing them to be have a recognition that they've got 12 years or whatever they decide when the states get together and decide what the length of the term limits are, they kind of set the rules, right? So they know that they only have so much time in office. And it will cause them, I think, to be a little bit more focused on accomplishing the work that's most important to them.
Isn't it true that the state's representative, I don't know if Representative McKenzie, one of you mentioned that there are 12 states that have passed resolutions calling for term limits. Isn't it true, though, that those states that have done this are states where referendum and initiative, like states that the one that everyone thinks of is California, but there are other states where voters get to answer a lot of questions on their ballots. And along those lines, we have a question from listener Stacy. Says, how can we as individuals help get term limits on the ballot? Representative McKenzie, is this something that you've thought about as a way for Pennsylvanians to actually have their voices heard?
Sure. So the way that the process would work here in Pennsylvania would be by a concurrent resolution through the House and Senate at the state level in Harrisburg. And so we are looking for grassroots support. So we encourage members to contact their state representatives, their state senators. You can do that on the U.S. Term Limits website, and that's a great way to do it. And we receive, as members, we receive those contacts. And then I think that people hearing from their constituents does motivate them to actually take action in Harrisburg. And so I think you're seeing that grassroots support bubbling up as the more we talk about it. Again, something like a hearing will help further put a spotlight on this issue. And we're going to hopefully then start to move it through the state legislature. And again, because they're disinterested parties, I think you can get a more accurate read on where members are, because it's not that they're term limiting themselves. This is about term limiting Congress. And so I think people are willing to support and represent their constituents. And obviously that's a good thing, because the establishment in Washington, D.C., I don't believe, even though they could pass this on their own, I don't see them taking it up. And so we have the opportunity to act as constituents and as citizens. And so I think this is the best avenue to go. So I would just encourage everybody to start voicing their support to their members in the state legislature.
I want to go down through a list of pros and cons of term limits. The three of you have touched on some of these things. I'm not going to go down through all of them, but some of the things that have been mentioned. For those who support term limits, that they would encourage politicians to have courage. It would limit the potential for corruption in government. Everyone could have influence in government. Could influence or could limit the influence of corporate lobbying, stop various political games that people play, encourage more people to vote, bring new ideas into Congress. You've touched on that. Changes the perspective of what it means to be a politician. Bring some centrism back to government. Now, those that oppose some of the cons of this proposal. Term limits would force good politicians to retire from Congress. It would change how politicians approach Washington. There could be a politician who decides they don't care. We would lose the networking benefits of our elected officials. It takes power away from voters. Term limits would not stop the deference behavior in Congress. The structure would limit the incentives for gaining policy expertise. It would not shift the power dynamics in Washington. And term limits have zero legislative support. So the three of you, when you hear those pros and cons, I know you've heard them all before, but I just wanted to lay that out there for our listeners that they have some context here. Let me ask you, Ken Quinn, what's the most important of those pros and cons? What's the most important? What sticks out? What should voters consider the most?
Our will. We want this. we demand this, and that's the job of our state legislatures to pass it. It's also the job of our federal legislators to listen to us. They're not listening. So we're not going to wait for them anymore. We're going to get this done without their consent. That's the number one reason. This is the will of the American people. It has been for decades. And whenever it's typically provided to the... Now, I want to go back to the question that you received about putting on the ballot. Unfortunately, that's been done. I explained that a little bit earlier in case you weren't there. It was passed by 21 states at the ballot box, and the U.S. Supreme Court overturned that. So this is nothing we will ever be able to vote for. It can only be done through Article 5. And that is why we need the state legislatures to step up and do this, because otherwise Congress is going to continue this path that it's on, unchecked in its power, and nothing is going to change. And, the initiative and referendum, that's a great point. This is basically the state legislature's initiative and referendum, which is a nice way of looking at it. And that's why we need the supporters out there. I want to mention, please go to our website. It's termlimits.com. termlimits.com. That is how you can get involved. And we need your help in Pennsylvania. We'll be sending out some calls to action. We want to thank Representative McKenzie for leading this in the House, being our sponsor, and we want to support him as much as we can.
Representative McKenzie, we have a question from Amy, who says that she wholeheartedly supports term limits, but she wants to know whether this is something that would apply to the state level as well, because we've been talking about congressional term limits. Do you support term limits on the state level?
Yeah, and so I do support term limits at the state level. It would have to go through a separate process. We would just be able to pass legislation to do that. And it's something that I've advocated for, supported in the past. But again, you see the nature and the momentum behind the establishment. That's something that never even gets considered. And so, again, that's where I think we do have an opportunity, though, to speak in the state legislature about Congress and have the opportunity to have disinterested parties take up that legislation. So I'm more optimistic on that front. While I support it at both levels, I think I'm actually more optimistic that I would see the change at the congressional level via the Article 5 proposal that we talked about already.
Let's take a phone call from Laura in Palmyra. Laura, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, welcome.
All right, so I am, thank you. I'm against term limits for two big reasons. One, I think it lets the voters off the hook. The framers of our Constitution deliberately made, for example, two-year limits for the House of Representatives because they wanted to be, hold office holders accountable, and we also hold the voters accountable. They need to pay attention. They need to actually vote. I would rather work on getting more people to vote, so and more people engaged, more civic engagement, rather than worrying about term limits. And the second thing would be, in that last term, there's no accountability. They can do whatever they want, and for a six-year Senate term, that's a long time. They can do a lot of damage if somebody loses their integrity, loses, there's things they can, I shouldn't say there's bad things they can do. They can not really care what the voters want because there's no accountability to those voters anymore because they're going to be ending their term. So that's my point.
All right, Laura, thank you very much for your call. Ken Quinn, what about what Laura has to say?
Yeah, well, when it comes to the choice, Thomas Jefferson, when he read the Constitution, he wasn't part of drafting it, but he sent a letter to Madison, and he said, there's two things I hate about the Constitution. Number one, he didn't put in a Bill of Rights. Number two, he didn't put in term limits, what he called rotation of office, especially for the president. And he went on to say the reason why it was critical is because if somebody can hold office for life, the people will not vote them out. And he was correct. And that is what we're experiencing today with members of Congress. We do have, actually, term limits will give us more choices as the voters. And just because somebody can't hold a seat for life doesn't mean they cannot serve any longer. They could go from one position to another, from the House to the Senate. There's hundreds of positions people can fill their entire life serving a government and the people. And, that's pretty much how the framers did it. They bounced around. They didn't hold, for the most part, those seats for very long. And so You know, we have a saying at U.S. Term Limits. We do have term limits as either death, dementia, or indictment. And unfortunately, we need to have the limits, the time that people spend limited, because what we're seeing is that with all this institutional knowledge that we currently, I did a research on this, is 8,000 years of institutional knowledge currently sitting in Congress. How is that working out for us? And that's taking into consideration 50% of members of Congress were former state legislatures, and their average tenure is 10 years. And so we have all this state level experience, federal level experience, and we continue to not get what we want as the American voters. What they're doing is, and this was a study by Princeton, if 80% of the voters want something, it will not, Congress will not listen. They are only listening to their funders, and they're approving that day after day. So that is why we're strongly supporting this issue.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Laura. Jim is in Berks County. Jim, you actually have a question or a comment that several people have brought up. Jim, you're on the air.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. First of all, I got to say, this is a bit of a one-sided program. Should have been a lot more balanced. But my primary thing is the big elephant in the room here that nobody is addressing is gerrymandering. Because gerrymandering has a whole lot more to do with people being difficult to dislodge for Congress than anything else. Gerrymandering is addressed, I am not in favor of term limits because it's taking my right away to vote for someone who is an effective congressperson.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. And as far as balance goes, not every show we do is a debate. Mike Riley with U.S. Term Limits. Gerrymandering, as I said, several people have brought up redistricting as being one of the main ways to maybe the reform that is needed the most before we even talk about term limits.
So I'm not really sure how to address that. I do agree that gerrymandering can be a very contentious topic. But it doesn't really affect what we're trying to accomplish with U.S. term limits and limiting the level of time that people have at the congressional level. You know, when the U.S. Congress has an approval rating of 25% or 20%, according to the latest polls, I'm not sure how people are arguing that they have effective representation in the U.S. Congress when 80% of the people think we need term limits and 80% of the people think Congress is not being effective and doing a good job. You know, Laura made the comment about, you know, they could go off the rails in their last term. And I agree that that is a risk. But I would also say that I would argue that right now we have Congress that's gone off the rails in very various topics or things. You know, there's a lot of very contentious topics across the United States that Congress has failed to take up. And it doesn't matter whether you're a Republican or you're a Democrat, you know, things like gun control safety or healthcare for everybody or fixing the healthcare system so that people have a right to healthcare if they have pre-existing conditions. There's a lot of things that Congress is not being addressed, that has not addressed, that need to be resolved. And so that's kind of why I think that this is such an important topic and the time to do it is now. Over the last 30 years, Congress has gotten older and they're moving further away from their constituents and not fixing problems that are having detrimental effects to all of our lives on a regular basis.
Well, I think the reason that so many people brought up redistricting or to try to stop gerrymandering is that it would give or it could give voters more choices, and that you wouldn't have legislators who have safe districts where they don't have opponents or they have that they're pretty much assured of being reelected. Gentlemen, we're almost out of time. I want to thank the three of you. Obviously, this is something that I think we'll have to address again. Mike, Mike Riley's legislative advocate with U.S. Term Limits, Ken Quinn, Northern Regional Director of U.S. Term Limits, and Republican State Representative Ryan McKenzie. Thank the three of you for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Have a nice day.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. WITF-TV is offering a free documentary screening and panel discussion around Ken Burns' latest film, The Gene, An Intimate History. It's tonight at 7 o'clock. It involves powerful personal stories, breakthroughs that reveal the historic search for the human genome, and the promise of modern research. Joining us now is one of the panelists on for that screening tonight, Dr. James Broach. He's distinguished professor and chair of the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at Penn State Hershey and director of Penn State's Institute for Personalized Medicine. Dr. Broach, what is individualized medicine?
Good morning, Scott. Pleasure to be here. Personalized or precision medicine is the concept of using an individual's genetic makeup as a means of informing the clinician and other caregivers about what diseases an individual may be predisposed to, or if they come down with a disease, what would be the optimum treatment to be able to address that disease.
So I think you've touched on this a little bit, but give us some hands-on how this is being used today, particularly at the Hershey Medical Center, Penn State's Hershey Medical Center. Understand there's a repository of biological samples. So how those samples, how are they used?
Correct, Scott. We've been collecting samples for the probably for about 20 years now. From patients that come in for anything from ALS to various cancers. And those are used to be able to identify genetic changes or genetic spectrum that may be associated with a particular disease. So we can identify, for example, in a family, a gene that may be predisposing an individual to thyroid cancer, which is what we've done in the past, or we can identify genes that may be predisposing a person to Lou Gehrig's disease. I think that the one clear example of the way this genomics and personalized medicine is being applied is predominantly in the area of oncology and cancer. I think that in the film, Ken Burns' film, they go into one particular case identifying an individual with gallbladder cancer and show that by using the genetic information that defines what genes have been altered to drive that particular tumor, they were able to come up clinicians were able to come up with a treatment that was extremely effective in reversing that that tumor. This is the approach that's generally being used at this point in cancer treatment. An individual patient that comes in with a tumor or another, a leukemia or other cancer, the clinicians send that sample off for being genetically tested to determine what changes have occurred in that tumor that are responsible for its growth. By doing that, they're able to pick from a large armamentarium of possible drugs the one that is absolutely precise for treating that cancer. So this has moved in the last 10 years and with an accelerating pace of being able to define how you treat a patient, not on the basis of, for example, where a cancer arises, that is, whether it's lung or stomach or gallbladder, but in fact, what are the genetic signatures of that, and thus pick a treatment that has the highest likelihood of being extremely effective. And this has basically revolutionized the way cancer treatment is performed, and really holds the promise of bringing an end to cancer.
You just touched on where I was going with my questioning. You use the word treatment. It has revolutionized how we treat types of cancer, for example. Has this, you know, what we've done in the last 30 years, because gene therapy has really kind of started in the early, or I shouldn't say started, but started getting momentum in the early 90s. You said that in the last 10 years, we've seen a whole lot of momentum, a whole lot of progress. But you mentioned treatment. Have there been any cures as a result of gene therapy?
So gene therapy is slightly different than the situation that I was describing for cancers. In gene therapies, we're looking at individuals that are born with a genetic defect and then are looking for opportunities to reverse the genetic mistake that was made and that causes that person to have a particular disease. There are several cases that are described in the film, in Ken Burns' film, and I think that they are really illuminative and well worth your audience spending some time looking at. But the in one case where a gene is missing, it's now beginning to become possible to restore that a good copy of that defective gene to an individual in which it's missing. And they provide one or two examples in the film in which that is now just beginning to come to the fore. It's not widespread at this point, but it's enough cases have been documented to say this is has a potential for future events. Another case that was described is sickle cell anemia that I'm sure most of your audience is familiar with. In this case, an individual with sickle cell is producing a toxic copy of a gene. In this case, the gene that produces hemoglobin, and it's making a bad copy of the hemoglobin gene. And a recent therapeutic approach, very clever on the part of the clinicians and scientists that were responsible for developing it. The investigators introduce into the bone marrow of a patient a gene that allows a different hemoglobin gene to turn on. So now you're making a good copy of the gene. And concurrent with that, the gene turns off the bad copy of the gene. So not only do you get a functional hemoglobin back, you remove the effect of, you remove the toxic gene and basically provide a cure or an effective treatment for that disease. Again, gene therapy has been discussed, as you point out, for years. And I think that after some a few setbacks along the way, the scientists and clinicians are now being able to bring that to the clinic. And we now have enough cases in which it's been shown to be effective that we can anticipate that this is likely to be an approach that will be used moving forward.
We have a question from a listener, and I think it's a good one because just yesterday we talked about the affordability of healthcare in this country. And Kit asked, can the American healthcare system handle so many variances in the human genome? Can the individual treatments offered be affordable to each individual patient? Will standardization be a part of this system of treatments?
It's a wonderful question. And the economics of healthcare, particularly in light of these new technological advances, is a very extensive topic and worth of multiple hours of discussion on its own. But let me say this at the beginning. Currently, insurance companies will pay, say, for a sick child in the neonatal intensive care unit to have their genome sequenced for a very expensive amount to try to identify what is the defective gene that's responsible for putting that infant into the NICU. That's the cost of that currently would pay for 100 people to have their genomes sequenced at the beginning of life. And so I can anticipate as we go forward, a very cost-effective approach would be to bring whole genome sequencing, or at least a form of that, into neonatal care, so that instead of having the state, for example, take a blood stick from an infant's heel, as they do now, and test for 60 genetic defects, you test for the entire genomic endowment of that individual, and therefore know at the very beginning all of the diseases to which that individual may be predisposed, and be able to anticipate and obviously develop approaches to avoid diseases that individual may be subject to. So in the long term, I see that the effectiveness of being able to do early sequencing of a large number of individuals will be extremely cost effective. Another case in which this is true is looking at people's ability to metabolize drugs. So it's very easy to do a test at this point to determine exactly how effective an individual is at metabolizing any of 100 different drugs that a clinician might prescribe going forward. And in studies in Canada and elsewhere, being able to apply that test proves extremely cost-effective, and being able to pick the right drug at the right time and therefore save lots of money in the actual treatment of that patient, even before you decide what drug is being done. So I think that the opportunity here is both economic as well as health, in that by applying genomics early and being able to pick the right treatment at the right time, we can avoid diseases and avoid going down the wrong path of a patient's treatment before we spend all the money to do so. So I think that there certainly are costs that are going to be associated with bringing technology and cutting edge technology into the clinic. But at the same time, there are opportunities for cost savings that would be, I think, quite remarkable.
Dr. Broach, we only have a minute. I'm going to have to hold you to a minute. This, you know, for many people, they hear this and they think it sounds so futuristic, but much of this is happening right now. But what does the future look like? And I have to hold you to a minute, Doctor.
Right. The future is amazing. I think that the opportunities to be able to define new treatments based on what we understand about a person's genetic makeup is really just beginning. The ability to treat cancers is really having a remarkable impact. And I think as the future moves forward, we have the opportunity to intercede in genetic defects that people are born with. And basically provide cures for something that was really not feasible even 10 years ago.
Dr. James Broach is a distinguished professor and chair of the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at Penn State Hershey and director of Penn State's Institute for Personalized Medicine. Dr. Broach, thank you very much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure to be here, Scott.
Also, WITF-TV offering a free screening and panel discussion that Dr. Broach is part of around Ken Burns' latest film, The Gene and Intimate History, tonight at 7. Go to WITF.org to become part of that, you can be can watch that tonight. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.
The Gene on WITF is supported by Capital Blue Cross.